This episode is proudly brought to you from 99designs by Vista, a global creative platform that makes it easy for you to work with professional freelance designers from around the world.
What you need is thirst. You need to be a thirsty human
who is intent on learning.
It's a really fascinating exploration of human potential.
Now. The Founder Podcast. Even the greatest entrepreneurs had help. If you want to learn from the most successful founders on the planet, you are in the right place. Branson, Mark Cuban, Tony Robbins, Tim Ferriss, Arianna Huffington, Seth Godin, Steve Case, Gary Vee, Sophia Amoroso, Barbara Corcoran, Damon John. Learn from the greatest minds in business today with interviews hosted by Nathan Chan. This is not your average entrepreneur podcast. The Founder Podcast.
Hey, Founder fam, welcome back to another episode of the Founder Podcast. Today, we're in the studio sitting down with wife and husband duo, Julia and Geordie Kay, co-founders of Great Wrap, which is the only compostable stretch wrap made from food waste. And they're really reimagining today's materials to solve tomorrow's problems with a 10-year vision of a world where plastic doesn't exist. We'll be going deep on the importance of building a mission-led company, how that landscape is being challenged by them, and how to build a sustainably focused business, as well as the experience with product development and innovation, and how to go bold, how to build a massive business. These guys are really doing some cool stuff. So please welcome to the Founder Podcast, Julia and Geordie Kay. The first question I ask everyone that comes on is, how did you get your job, aka how did you find yourself doing the work you're doing today?
It's a very good question. To start off with, neither of us were involved in packaging really by any stretch of the word prior to, 4 years ago. I was working in architecture for, a decade, really passionate about the materials that I was building with and the processes that were sort of going into how they were being made. For me, though, no matter how much I was putting effort into this sort of side of what I was doing, there was a big problem with still all of the products arriving wrapped in petroleum-based pallet wrap on site. So I was just seeing, a huge amount of waste, was really frustrated, wanted to do something about it. And then I met Geordie, we fell in love. And
yeah, I think this is probably within 3 months of meeting each other. We were, technically co-founders. So it was pretty quick into it. But prior to that, I was making wine. I'd done that since I was 15. Grew up in a wine region, dropped out of high school, moved to Europe, worked in a lot of organic and biodynamic vineyards, came back, started my own wine label, leased a vineyard in Red Hill, which is about an hour and a half south of Melbourne. And farmed organically, made wines naturally, using no preservatives, ended up having distributors all over the world. And, it was like reasonably successful. I was able to buy a small vineyard and then, we sort of met and I had this sort of growing frustration of, it kind of felt like the world was somewhat sort of burning down around us and, kind of felt like, well, it's great that I was farming organically and making wines naturally and they were enjoyed at restaurants and people loved drinking them and it was fantastic to be a part of that community, but definitely felt like, I think we both kind of wanted to push ourselves a little bit further beyond what we were doing. And, really cliche, but like walking along a beach, talking about these frustrations and talking about plastic and climate change and, what could we do? And sort of started speaking about, pallet wrap, it's this massive, massive problem. And I think a lot of products out there are, consumer products like coffee cups compostable bags that are trying to replace single-use plastic. But we sort of thought, well, it's like the biggest single-use plastic. And so, yeah, that kind of conversation on a beach led to a business being registered within about a month.
Yeah, I think as well, knowing the products both so well and just like the vast amounts and the fact that you can be making wine, you can be designing buildings, you can be working in retail, but everyone's sort of touching this product and no one had seemed to have thought about it at that point. like, I think this could be our opportunity. And that was the beginning.
I don't know if it really answered the question or not, but
yeah, still that's not cool. Really sure what happened between that and now. But
yeah, okay. All right, I want to delve a little deeper. So how did you guys meet? When did you guys meet?
We met at a pub called Marquis of Lawn in Fitzroy, which is a suburb of Melbourne. I was doing a couple of shifts pouring beers behind the bar, and Julia walked in. We sort of had a lot of mutual friends, so sort of knew of Julia.
Yes.
And I thought she was already on a date with someone else, but I was like, I'd already had a big crush on her from knowing about her through friends. So I just went and sat at the table and just like, had
supposed a date. Yeah. It wasn't a date. I was with a friend.
Yeah, I didn't know that. And the next week we went out to a gig. I bought tickets to a Lauryn Hill gig. Yeah, but they were like counterfeit or something. I didn't know
they're
that.
Like scalped.
Scalped tickets. Yeah, I bought them online. Yeah. And then we got there and they were like, no, you can't enter. And we ended up just having this like really hilarious, like funny night out. And just went to, it was, I don't know, just like went to funny bars and went to some like drama performance bar, Witches in Britches, but just sort of like kind of, you know, snuck in and I don't know, it was just a really hilarious night. So it was a lot of fun. So I think from that night on, we knew probably going to be together forever.
Yeah. And so that was when? 2018, 17, 16?
Start of 2019, February. Yeah.
Okay, so started 2019 February, and then 3 months later, you guys were walking on a beach and came up with this business idea.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then 3 months after that, we're engaged.
Yep. Yeah.
It's awesome.
Very quick. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you know, right?
That's it.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly right.
So, 2020, you came up with this idea, but you didn't know. You thought of the problem first. This is an interesting take. So you thought of the problem first, but you didn't actually know how you were going to solve it. Like you didn't know because you guys ended up working with a university to come up with the first version of the product. I'd love to talk about that. So that it was a problem first. That's how you started.
Yeah, definitely problem first. I think the way we thought we were going to approach the problem was probably really different to how, you know, it's ended up being. When we first started, we did a lot of research to begin with.
Yeah.
We found a product that was, you know, similar. It was a compostable product. It was made of, you know, I guess better than plastic, but not where we wanted to be, sort of feedstocks. And we had that contract manufactured by someone else. And I think through that process, our kind of business model eventuated. We realized that, you know, you really need to manufacture a product yourself if you want full visibility over what's going into it and quality and things like that. But yeah, problem first. And then there was a big evolution of how we'd attack it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're definitely like, we're customers of the problem.
Yeah. Know?
Like, we needed a product. We really wanted this product in our businesses because we were using pallet wrap a lot. And we knew that there was a lot of other people like us out there. So it kind of just seemed pretty straightforward. Well, if we make that product that'll solve this problem for us, then it's a pretty good business idea, you know? And that was sort of the pathway we went down is trialing kind of like a minimum, you know, MVP and of having a contract manufactured product to kind of test the market. And that launched in March 2020. So it was we were doing a shoot for it with The Age. And I remember the photographer was there and they were going to, you know, put it in the newspaper the next day. And they said, oh, look, I'm really sorry, I've got to go. We've just had Australia's first COVID case. You know, or Melbourne's first COVID case. Okay, it was one of the two. But
yeah,
perfect time to launch.
Yeah, and we launched the next day, and it was like great for about 3 days, and then it was just, you know, crickets.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that's pretty fast timing with the launch. And you said it was a bit of a journey. It's been a journey to where you guys are now. So you thought of the problem, and how did you find that first version of putting getting the product and then selling it? Can you talk us through that? How did you get your first customers? Like, talk us through all of that, because that seems like you guys moved pretty fast.
Yeah, so the first product we, you know, obviously just like went online, found someone who's manufacturing compostable products to see if this is something that they could do for us.
And it was compostable shrink wrap.
Correct.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. For making pallet wrap. And
yep.
And, yeah, we found someone online, sent some products over, went back and forth. At one point we were going to go there but couldn't at the time, or something happened. But that period took about, it was probably from, I'd say, sort of May, you know, 2019 to March 2020 launching. Yep. Of just sending materials back and forth, trying things. There's a lot of sort of failed attempts.
Yeah.
And working really closely with them.
Mm, yeah. But in the meantime, while we were doing that product development, and mind you, I was still working full-time at the studio at this point, but yeah. We'd also started to do all of the things that you need to kind of build a brand. So, you know, I'd spend a lot of time in Photoshop after work, yes. You know, built a website that was, you know, very, very basic. Looking back at it now, it makes me feel a little bit sick to the stomach. But, you know, we had an Instagram account set up, and I think we'd started talking about the product yes. a lot. And just you know, like you reached out to a lot of winemaker friends, just kind of gathering as much information around, was it just us that wanted this in our business, or is this something that's important to people? How price sensitive are they? You know, is this important, essentially? And by the time we did have that product, we'd sort of, you know, when we did go live with it, I think we had, you know, $30,000 of sales within the first 24 hours. Just off the, you know, like at this point, I had no idea about digital marketing, and
yes.
it was all just kind of
organic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we put a lot of effort into having customer conversations.
Like, yes.
I remember, like, I was still making wine, so just could easily chat with big winemakers, distributors, yeah. supermarket chains, all of those yeah. sort of folks, and they were really keen to solve this problem as well, so they were really open to that discussion. Didn't feel like I was trying to sell them something, maybe because we didn't have a product at that point.
Yeah, we didn't realize we were trying to sell things yet.
Yeah, yeah. So your customer base was B2B.
Yeah.
Mainly. At that stage, yeah.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
Definitely. I think that shifted because of COVID, really.
Yes.
I think immediately when, you know, after that launch moment when it felt like, I mean, it's weird to go back to, but it did feel like people were going to stop moving things around the planet, like freight, you know, everything was yes. kind of on hold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for us, we were spending a lot of time at home. Everyone was in the kitchen with yes. leftovers, and that's when we kind of decided to venture into the direct-to-consumer product.
Yes. So that was basically just after you launched, a month after, 2 months?
It still took about 6 months to get the product perfect. Again, it yep. was, but trying to do that even quicker than before.
Yes.
And then organize packaging and, you know, at this point it was like that first lockdown where it just felt like, I don't know, it's very doom and gloom. You couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't see anyone.
Yeah.
It was all, you know, it was just hard. But, yeah, within about 6 months, we'd updated the brand a bit, changed it more as a consumer product, changed the way we spoke about the product. And, we launched with a cling wrap. In America, they would call it saran wrap. And
yep.
we launched with a cling wrap for home. Yep. And we had an article in, like, a popular Australian sort of food and beverage magazine called Broadsheet, and the next day we did $100,000 in sales.
Yeah,
wow. So we did more in sales than when we did pallet wrap launch and had a lot of really positive emails and people reaching out, and we were like, okay, well, obviously there's an interest in both of these two things now, and yeah.
At that point we were still packing from the lounge room, so.
Yep. Shopify store.
Shopify store.
Yeah,
that's it.
All of that.
Yeah, it was funny.
Awesome. So we talked about it offline. We have a mutual friend who's one of your early stage investors, and the way that he now it's funny hearing the journey, because the way that he describes your business to me when we were talking about it, he's like, you guys have a unique method now of creating this wrap, and I think are going through the process of patenting it or have already, and apparently, please correct me if I'm wrong, that there's another company that owns basically the monopoly of creating plastic wrap, like the shrink, I call it shrink wrap, you guys, what do you guys call it?
Pallet wrap.
Yeah, I call it shrink, because I used to work at Target in the loading dock, so I know. I used to use them all the time, right? I used to do it. Yeah. So, So that's really kind of where the business is going now,
yep.
Right? So, and you guys have raised, you just did a Series A last year, you raised $24 million. So you've kind of gone through a few pivots. So that's how I know the business now. So talk me through that journey, because it sounds like during COVID, the direct-to-consumer stuff was doing quite well. So what happened next, and when did you start working with Monash University to create this special technology to create the wrap in a purely biodegradable way?
Yeah. So I think, we launched Consumer in July 2020, and then September 2020, we had our first research agreement underway with Monash University, so Australia's largest university.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Why did you decide to do work with them, and how did that come about and go down this path? Because it sounds like you guys could have kept going with your current supplier, right?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I think we were, transparency around the product was not there. Also, probably, we couldn't get over there. We saw that there was actually a better, more sustainable way to make the product that probably hadn't been, commercialized yet. And we wanted to be the ones to do that.
Yeah, definitely. Like it's like shrink wrap, pallet wrap, it's a price sensitive product. So you have to make it as cheap as possible. And we obviously wanted to continue to make it as sustainable as possible. So we were using materials that are imported, used cornstarch as a feedstock, which requires intensive agriculture. So we wanted to switch to a process that was the most sustainable and affordable process as well. So I think traditionally someone who makes shrink wrap would be a manufacturer like us.
Yes.
And they would purchase their products from either ExxonMobil or Dow Chemicals.
Yes.
And it's already sort of pre-made chemicals, ready to go, put it in the line, and you're off and making products. So we knew that we had to be the Exxon or Dow as well in our business model. So we had to make the raw material, then we had to manufacture it into a product and then be the distributor all in one, so that we could compete on price but also have a lot more control over the performance of our product. And so that conversation started with Monash in September 2020, with just a friend of mine who I'd met at this youth leadership program in Canberra about 10 years prior. We were just in this focus group together and just sort of stayed in contact because he was into chemical engineering and biology and I was, fascinated by that. His name's Eddie. Reached out to him and said, hey, we're doing this thing. Would you be able to sort of help us out? He worked at the Food Innovation Lab at Monash. And, we ended up working extremely closely with him to develop another sort of group of people there to develop a system to convert potato waste into a biopolymer called PHA.
Yes.
Often seen as a silver bullet in biopolymers because PHA, unlike other bioplastics, it can break down in the ocean as well as all other environments. So if you drop, PHA in the ocean in under 6 months, it can completely disappear. So it's made by bacteria that feed on food waste, as an example, as a feedstock. And then that bacteria produce a natural occurring polymer. And if you were to return that back to soil, return it to ocean or landfill, it completely breaks down once they're exposed to the bacteria again. So we started working with them to create a system in which we could own the complete sort of vertical integration of the business. And, I think since then, that's, 3 years ago or a little less, but we've taken that to pilot scale, working with a partner in Europe, and next year we're actually going to build that system, which anyone who knows PHA or this field, it is just crazy rapid pace to be able to build a biorefinery to produce PHA from potato waste. And we're really happy that we'll be able to do that within 4 years, which, it sometimes doesn't give you a lot of hope about the state of the world and the technology we need, because to work with the university and then scale it up and then commercialize it, it's a long and slow process.
Yeah, wow. So talk me through kind of working with the university and how that, because who owns the IP? All of that. How does that work? And then now you guys are commercializing it. How does that work?
Yes.
And they funded everything. How does that? Yeah.
We got that funded through a research grant, CRCP. There is a CRCP round currently open, closes next week. I would encourage anyone to apply for it. It's Australian research. They have similar ones in the US, like NSF. Usually have grants that are very, very similar, in which you partner with a university and then you have to enter an IP agreement, ownership agreement prior to. So we owned the IP from this that was created. It was sort of funded, co-funded by the government and us. And with the idea of trying to create new technology that could be commercialized. So I guess we're lucky that, you know, we're one of the success stories of the CRCP program. And but, you know, I think in that, what we found during this process is what we could create with Monash was nowhere near complete to what we actually needed to do to commercialize. And what we found was there was all these companies and universities and sort of folks working on similar things around the world, but a lot of people working in silos because everyone's obsessed with owning the IP. And, you know, I think we're obsessed with trying to collaborate and sort of solve problems. So we were able to work with, you know, a university and a private company in Belgium. We're able to work with another company down in Geelong, focusing on technology that they've developed that makes our system far more efficient than it possibly could be. So some of that technology we license, some of it we purchase, and then some of it we've developed with Monash, and we bring it all together to create a super system that's far more efficient than if we just built it in a silo and we owned all of the IP ourselves. And that's really common in startup world, but I think it's without a doubt the worst way. Like it works for some, but I think if you can scale by licensing and partnering, then you're going to get the job done much better and you're going to get the best technology in your system. Because like an iPhone, you know, if you open it inside, they don't own all of that IP. Yes. There's a whole bunch of IP that's constructed and licensed and put together. So, you know, I think it's just the best way to build new products.
Awesome. So talk me through kind of, so you, while you were doing the direct to consumer, you kind of had the, you were kind of doing two work streams. You were doing all the research in the background for a kind of version two of your product, right? And then how did you make the pivot to kind of go back to B2B, or do you still do a lot of the D2C stuff? Talk us through that and where your focus is.
Yeah, I think Pallet Wrap's always been the goal, I think, for us from an impact perspective, right? Yeah. You know, like it's really important to get people in their homes to be making this shift and understanding that it's important. Yes. But to see the shift that the world needs, it has to be at scale. So I think we always wanted to remain a B2B business. We learned really quickly that the scale, you know, we set up our pilot facility and we were manufacturing, you know, 1,000 rolls a day and talking to customers that, you know, would essentially just eat us alive if we had to supply for them. So we realized we had to upscale our manufacturing facility considerably if we wanted to do that. But also we learned that the direct-to-consumer brand gave us a really great opportunity to build on, I guess, the education, the community piece. You know, there's a lot of things that are sort of peripheral to what we do that are really important, you know, around waste infrastructure and things like that. And the direct-to-consumer brand has given us a tool and a vehicle to talk about all of that while we work on the B2B. So we've kept doing the direct-to-consumer and we will continue to do it. We're launching Pallet Wrap soon, but it will be really interesting to kind of navigate what the brand looks and sounds like when we're doing both of those. But yeah, I think it's nice to have. I think also like we've realized that all of these huge businesses that you just see as a brand name are actually made up of people that are consumers that have a kitchen and understand these things. So if you can connect on a more personal level, it's really beneficial.
Mm. So one way Jake also described what you guys are doing to me is he said that you guys are really going for it. You guys are going big and bold and there's a lot of risk.
You kind of like, I think that, again, with like shrink wrap and pallet wrap, it's a commoditized type product and you kind of have to go big or else you're going to be like four times the price and, you know, it's too expensive for a lot of other companies to use it. So you want to, you know, shoot for the stars. And so, yeah, we decided pretty early on, like, before we raised our first round of investment, which, you know, Jake participated in, our pre-seed, which was in February 2021, we, you know, we were talking about it. We had this government grant. We were going through an accelerator that was paid as well through StartMate. So we said we had a bit of cash. Yeah, we were cashed up. We were able to, like, not huge amounts, but, you know, we were able to like leave our careers and we were kind of like, well, what do we do here? Like, do we set up a small factory? We could run a really good consumer, you know, product out of that. And we own 100% of the company and it's great. Or do we really tackle this and actually try and solve a problem? And at the end of the day, we're like, well, we're an impact driven company. Like, it'd be great if, you know, we could own 100% of the company, have a bit of wealth, buy a yacht. It'd be fantastic. Everyone wants to do that. But at the end of the day, like, we were trying to reach as many people and businesses as possible. And to do that, we had to swing for the fences. And yeah, that's exactly what we did.
I think also, you know, the implication, like, we're a manufacturing business as much as we are, you know, biotech and brand and all of these things. So I think there's also just like the flat out financial risk there, right? You know, like, we've got millions of dollars worth of machinery, we've got a huge lease, and it's really different to, you know, a tech company where you can just see the growth of team and almost like multiply. I'm probably simplifying this. You can tell we don't have a tech company, but simple, you know, you can, it's like a multiplier on your revenue. You can map that out really clearly. It's a bit different when you're talking brick and mortar and manufacturing and mechanical engineering. I think there's a lot of risk, but it's exciting and fun.
Yeah, that's it. Like, we took on $13.5 million worth of debt, you know, and that was to finance all of our assets for manufacturing. We're in a 10,000 square meter facility, which is the wow. size of, you know, a couple of football fields. So, like,
wow.
we had to go big, and we've done that, and you know, and during that process as well, like, we haven't built that biorefinery, so we still don't own the process completely where we process the potato waste on site. We work with other companies now doing that, and then we also do a lot of the process on site as well as the manufacturing. But it's a sort of not a clunky system, but it's not completely finished yet. And so we're kind of operating at that sort of style at the moment, which has allowed us to scale, but we haven't even sort of really reached the full potential of this new site that we took about a year ago. But, I mean, that's all in the space of 2 years since we made that decision, which, yeah, we're really proud of that, how fast we've been able to do that and swing for the fences like that. But, you know, there's still a lot of risk. Like, it hasn't, like, you know, materialized fully yet. Like, we've still got a solid sort of couple of years until I think we'll start to relax a bit and sleep a little better.
Mm, what do you think the biggest risk is?
I mean, I think for me, yours might be different, but I don't feel that the risk lies in demand. Like, it's very clear, you know, we've got, you know, some of the largest Australian brands, really large American brands waiting to pilot with our pallet wrap. Like, the demand is there.
Yes.
I think the biggest risk is, you know, can we get the efficiencies that we need to make this, you know, performance is already amazing, but, you know, at a price that people are willing to pay, that we can also build a profitable business, because that's really where the design work and the challenge for us lies at the moment. We'll definitely get there, but that's probably where it's at right now.
Yeah, like, we're about to relaunch Pallet Wrap in 2 weeks' time, and we have 3,000 businesses on a waiting list. We have about 100 paid pilots with some of the most iconic food and beverage global companies, as well as global retail supermarkets. And then it's like, well, if everyone says yes and you can't execute, well, that's a huge risk. Yeah. Our prices are slight premium, and there's maybe like a lot of, we didn't expect people to not want to pay maybe 10% more, then there's a risk associated with that. And so we're kind of, at the moment, we're just sort of, yeah, those are the two biggest ones. Is we've got to figure those out.
I think we'll have a lot of clarity, honestly, in 6 weeks' time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Pre-launch is always a bit of a hairy time.
We can do a post-show quick little 1 minute touch base.
For the factory, yeah.
Or just for the Netflix sort of like the text on the screen at the end.
Awesome. So talk to me kind of like, you guys, it sounds like you guys have moved pretty fast, like from when you started to where you are now. You're building like a substantial business that's going to potentially, and I believe can and will, solve a massive problem in the world. Talk to me kind of like what hours are you guys doing and how do you maintain your relationship?
Yeah, for sure. You know, like I think, yeah, during that whole period, we got married in Feb 2020. And launched, you know, soon after. And so it's just like obviously growing a relationship when you're growing a business is, you know, a really unique thing. And what we found is, yeah, it brings unique challenges, but it also brings unique excitement because there's nothing more exciting than growing a company. Like it is so much fun, but there's also nothing more exciting than growing a relationship. And I think to do the two hand in hand at the same time has been like a lot of fun. And we're really lucky that we're, you know, like best friends as well as married and so we've, as well as co-founders. So, like, we've had a lot of fun and then when there's really tough days and you just, like, the machine's broken or, you know, you're having some issues with supply chain and you can just kind of, like, have a beer and chat about it and laugh about it or cry about it, whatever you feel like at that point. But to have that sort of shoulder to cry on and someone to sort of talk to about stuff and is really, really nice. And we're also co-CEOs, which I think is a really unique thing as well, is we're not, you know, I'm not like CTO and Julia's CMO or something like that.
Yeah.
But we're co-CEO and we share the responsibility of the company. We carve it out and we know who's sort of in charge of what. But to kind of share that responsibility, I mean, essentially we get, you know, two CEOs for the price of one. Like it's great. And, you know, Julia's got a really creative brain and I'm, I don't know, maybe more analytical, I guess, in certain things. But yes. I think, so yeah, like it works really well. We've just got two people sharing CEOs. So, and that's good. And then I think like work-life balance, like we didn't get right at the start and we could feel ourselves getting pretty burnt out.
Yeah.
And then I think probably about a year ago, really kind of pulled ourselves in and said, like, you know, we've got to make this, like, this is a marathon and to make this work, like, we're not going to sell the company next year. So, you know, we know we've got probably 10 years in the tank here that we've got to really last for. So, yeah, we really cut back on hours. We delegated more with the team. Our team's been amazing. They've just been incredible. We brought more people to the team after we did our raise. So, yeah, we've found a lot more balance, I think, as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, you know, coming from a background in architecture, typically doesn't have the best reputation for work-life balance at all. I think, like, actual hours at the desk, I'd be doing, you know, less now. And that's fantastic, right? I mean, I can't say that we're not talking about work when we're not at the desk, but, you know, that's probably because, you know, we're partners together. I do think that doing it together is really, it would be hard if I was going through this and Geordie wasn't in the business. I would probably be a really selfish partner or, you know, appear to be. And so I think it allows us to kind of understand what's going on for each other and, you know, it's good. It works.
Hey, Founder Fam, I want to take a quick break from the conversation to talk about a pain point for a lot of you out there. And that's finding quality design help to build your brand. Whether it's a logo, website, or packaging, you can spend hours trying to do it yourself and still end up with nothing. That's where 99 Designs by Vista comes in. With its contest model, you can invite an entire global creative community to participate in your project and submit ideas. It's like having an entire design department at your fingertips. And at Founder, we've worked with 99 Designs before in the past to create a special issue of our magazine. And it really transformed the quality of the project by having a bunch of concepts to choose from and being able to collaborate with creators from all over the world. From pitch to perfection, 99 Designs will be there with you every step of the way. They'll help you transform your idea in your head into a valuable piece of content or branding for your business. And together with 99 Designs, we're offering you a $30 discount on your first design contest. So just head to 99designs.com/founder to learn more or get started on your project today. Okay, now let's jump back into the episode.
And what advice would you give to anybody watching, listening, that perhaps are looking to go into business with their significant other?
I think the best thing we ever did was, like, day one, got a big piece of butcher's paper,
yes,
wrote out all of the roles that we thought would exist in a business at this point, which we didn't have full visibility over what that was, and essentially, you know, split it up and said, I'll own this and you own that. We talk to each other about everything, but at the end of the day, it's important that you have your own identity and your own, feel like you own a part of that. And if those boundaries aren't set really early on, it, you know, it can become frustrating and you're feeling like, you know, what, who am I? So I think that was really important to do for us. And then, you know, obviously you've just got to keep working on communicating and understanding each other and making time to have off as well. We just go for a hike without talking about work.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, it's like cliche, like communication is key, like really is. I mean, in any relationship, yeah. The co-founders or married or friends, like communication is just so important. And you just have to get really good at like communicating how you're feeling at any given point in the day, or how, you know, someone says something that makes that, you know, makes you feel a certain way when you're stressed, and you've just got to constantly communicate because it just makes it easy. And then after time you start to be able to read, you know, those sort of things, and yep. You get better at picking up on things. So, but yeah, always having that open line of communication. Don't ever sit on anything, bottle it up. I think, you know, it just any founders I know out there, I've got friends that have co-founded companies with other folks, and yeah, when it's broken down, it's like, it's just because one person's bottling things up and it comes to a head and they, you know, turns into a big outburst. So I think, yeah, having that communication is so important.
I think it's also an important one, and I don't know if this is healthy advice. I'm just going to preface it with that. No, I mean, to a certain extent it is healthy, but I think also, you know, there's like you think about it, you've obviously going to bring emotion to work, but yeah. I think in some instances you need to, if you're feeling something, just like recheck and go, is this about me or is this about the business? Because if it's about me, that's like fine and we can take that home and talk about it later. But if it's not what the business needs, like you kind of just need to recenter around that when you're at work, you know, and make those two different spaces. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing. I had to ask that question. I'm sure you probably get that all the time, no, right? You're only a business partner. But let's talk about some of the times. Have you guys ever experienced any feelings where it's so tough and you thought about giving up?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Can you tell us some stories?
Yeah, I feel like anyone would be lying if they said no, surely, to that. But, yeah, I'm trying to think of like some...
I've got a good one off the top of my head. definitely. And this was at the very beginning of the We Are Going to Become Manufacturers journey.
Yes.
We took on what felt big at the time, lease of a factory space, considerably smaller than what we have now, but still really big. And we moved. It was a very affordable lease for us at the time, but like that brought with it its challenges. It was like a warehouse that someone had, I think, someone had kind of just been hoarding a collection of cars in. So there was, I reckon, like 50 rusted cow bodies in there. And we, like, it was a really fun project, but we were like, we'll tidy this up, get this looking beautiful. But I think we'd done something silly, like setting a launch date into, we were shooting something for Netflix, like in 2 weeks' time. And it was like,
The machine hadn't arrived,
but it was like one of those shows, like The Block, but like no cameras. It was just like Geordie and I running around like with a gurney and like a paintbrush. And that was fun, but like by the end of that week, we were like, I don't know, this is pretty hard.
Yeah, I think it ended up stretching out for 3 weeks. We were able to push a couple of things and move. But at that point, like, we would contract manufactured everything. So we had to figure out how to manufacture ourselves as well as that. And we'd just done our first sort of raise. So we brought on a couple of people at that stage to kind of help. And it was, but they kind of came towards the end of it. So it was, yeah, really us like on, I don't know,
just on the tools,
on the tools, pretty hard. So that was pretty, like, a lot of tears, a lot of frustrations. And then
it was fun though.
Yeah. And I think like financial stress as well really adds, like at that point, you know, we just finished a raise. So we're like, yeah, we've got money, we can make this work. But then, you know, in between sort of our seed and Series A, we were scaling up to a much larger factory.
Yes.
And bringing on huge amounts of debt. We were growing the team. And we were missing deadlines. It was out of our control, but our equipment wasn't being made on time, and then was missing shipping deadlines. And it was just like everything kind of felt like it was going wrong. And we hadn't closed our Series A. And you're sort of like, like trust us with our money, but I know we're really late, but like we'll get there kind of thing. And it got really down to the wire there. That's like the most horrific stress, because you've got other people's money that you're already managing. You've got a team and you've got all these customers waiting, and you feel like you're really at the end of the road. So, I think any founder's been at that point, and you probably go through it once a year, really. But and it's how you deal with those emotions at the time. Do you sort of just shut up and turn into a little ball, or do you just go, okay, this is how it is, and I'm just going to fight my way through this?
Mm. And how do you deal with it? Like,
yeah, definitely. I think we went into just like wartime mode. We were just like, right, what can we do to make this work? Who can we call? You know, it was just like bringing on the investors, closing everything, getting the capital needed, required, and getting documents signed, and just like not abusing equipment suppliers, but just like, you've got it, whatever you can do. Like, we're completely ruined if you don't put this line to the front of the line.
Yeah.
And they came through and they pushed things forward and things fell into place, and there was a lot of screaming, and, you know, but like it came together. So it was just like, do you throw in the towel, or do you just go full fight mode? And
but there's also like a beautiful thing as well about those times, because, you know, like at this point we had an amazing team who weren't fully aware of what was going on, and, you know, like you wouldn't want to stress them out. And so, like, also I think showing up to work every day and being surrounded by people that are excited about what you're doing, like being able to draw on that was pretty powerful, I think. Like, it was really nice. It was, because it was hard. But just like knowing that you've got to like keep going for them and they're doing it for you, it's good.
Yeah, no, it was good. I feel like I had to apologize to a lot of people. Yeah. Sorry about the start of the year. It was just a bit of a stressful time.
Yeah, sorry. We're back. Because also, I mean, raising is just so time intensive, you know, like you've, especially when it's the both of us having to kind of be chatting with investors all the time, you know, you can easily be not the strongest manager in those times, which definitely is not the best.
Yeah, I think too, like when you're raising capital from investors, you don't want to come across as desperate. No. You want to be the opposite, and you want to be strong. And but, you know, at the same time, like, you've missed some deadlines. You had this perfect plan, and now the plan's not going to plan, and you've got to do whatever you can. So it's trying to put on like, a different face for your team and for investors. And it's a really tough rope to sort of walk. And I don't know. Like, I don't know if there's any advice in there except for just keep pushing until right at the end.
Mm. No, I admire your guys' courage. So.
Thank you.
Talk me through your latest round, because I look at a product and what you guys are building, and it seems like a no-brainer, right? Like the problem that you're solving and the good you're doing for the world from a sustainability standpoint. Has it been an easy like raise, like that Series A? Was it a no-brainer for most people, or like talk us through kind of that? Were there a lot of challenges? Did you have to speak to a lot of investors, or you already had a lot of conversations flowing, so then when you guys were ready, it was kind of a natural thing that came to life? Talk us through that.
It was a bit of a combination of everything. I think our, you know, because prior to that, the A, we did a pre-seed and a seed. And those were very different experiences. I think at that point, you know, there was a lot of money around. It was a very, you know, those sorts of rounds. It's about concept. You know, it's less about execution, which the A probably was more about. I think, like, we did speak to a lot of investors, but I think we'd already been introduced to some of them, so a lot of those conversations were easier. I think it was just like, how would you describe it? I feel like where we were at was really hard, because we were on the cusp of moving into, you know, the new factory and having the new product. So there was a lot of, we will do this. It was less about showing what we had done than I imagine our next round will be, which was kind of hard.
Yeah, I think like if we did our Series A today, I think it, not to be arrogant, but like it would have been very easy because like we're in this new site, we've got all this amazing infrastructure, our team are incredible, not that the team weren't then, but
and like a physical space.
Yeah, like through. you can walk into our site and it's visually very impressive and seeing all of the high-end, you know, equipment running and operating. And you go, yeah, cool. This, obviously, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But at that point, like, yeah, we'd signed the lease. Equipment was still being built in Europe. Mm. You know, like it was still, yes. We weren't quite there. Yes. And so I think for a lot of investors, there was a bit of concern. At this point, and you know, it was in start of 2022. So traveling wasn't really huge.
Yeah.
Still like for a lot of those investors, they, you know, weren't like flying around and coming visiting and stuff. So it was just like we were at a really awkward position, but we needed to do that raise so that we could set up this big factory and then scale that, you know, product. We were kind of probably a bit early to do a Series A, but for hardware, I mean, that's probably if we were like a B2B SaaS company, but for a hardware company, I think we did it at the perfect time. Like we'd proven out our pilot facility and we were scaling up to a big factory, like, made perfect sense to be doing a Series A. But for a lot of investors, there's no real sort of set, like there's no traditional metrics that you can kind of measure. It's all kind of gut feel. Like, where do you think they're at and do you think they're ready to do this next round?
That's probably the other thing that was, I guess, a challenge as well in a lot of the, you know, investors that we spoke to. Amazing, understood the vision and the values, but there aren't actually that many hardware investors out there compared to, I think, you know, we were speaking with a lot of people that were really interested in like the direct consumer piece and the brand, for example, but then we would start to talk about manufacturing and, you know, they'd get a bit spooked, which fair enough, it's very different.
Yes.
There are a lot of, because, you know, investment theses can be quite specific and I think our model's fairly unique, finding those people that understood all facets of what we were trying to do was probably a big challenge, or like understood why each piece was exciting. We did amazing and have a beautiful like cap table now, but I think we definitely found that like there'd be always a piece of the conversation that they'd be like, but why are you manufacturing yourself, or why is the direct to consumer important? Or
I think like, I mean, it made total sense because our Series A, like our two biggest investors, was one of Australia's largest agriculture companies, Thomas Foods, and Australia's largest supermarket chain, Woolworths, or their venture arm, W23. So two great companies that totally understood, it's a no-brainer, and totally understood this huge opportunity here and understood the challenges in scaling up, you know, hardware and facilities and things like that.
Mm, okay. Awesome. So I want to ask a couple last questions before we wrap. I'm going to move to the hot seat round. Mm-hmm. I have to ask you guys just around advice you would give to other early stage startup founders that want to build a business around sustainability. What advice would you give?
We say this one a lot, but definitely just speaking to as many customers as you can and understanding the problem as much as possible. It's like it is a really fast moving space, and fast moving not only in the technology but in consumer sentiment, and so you really need to be across that as much as possible. That's a big piece of advice, and like it sounds like a big deal when you say talk to a customer, but it's like just picking up the phone to a friend, or you know, it can be quite casual, doesn't have to feel intimidating at the start. But I think we learned a lot from that process, and still to this day, like, you know, 4 hours a week minimum, both of us would be talking to a customer and iterating off of that. So I think that's important.
Yeah, I think like, yeah, definitely like is just because your product is sustainable doesn't mean it'll sell. Like 5 years ago, there wasn't as many products that were sustainable. Now there's, you go down a supermarket aisle and you know, you're inundated with, you know, interesting packaging, interesting food sources, and then, you know, online and your sponsored feeds, everything. So it can't just be sustainable. Like it has to be a product that your customers want. So I think it's like really getting to know your customers, speaking to hundreds of them as, you know, if you can. I think we probably would have spoken to about 200 customers before we actually launched our product. So just like we were sending out mass emails, just speak to as many people as you can and make sure, you know, because it's easier to iterate when it's just a theoretical idea as opposed to when it's a physical form and then you need to go back and reverse engineer things.
Yeah, wow. Awesome. That's crazy. Yeah. I can't believe you spoke to that many customers.
Yeah. There's a lot of chats.
It was good, though. It was really good, you know, because, yeah, it's all about perspective, right?
And how did you know, though, when you'd had enough insight, like that enough was 200 or 100, like at what point? Or just...
I think we're probably more gut instinct on things like that, especially at that point. I think you can kind of tell proportionately, right? It gets to a point where you're like, okay, I'm speaking to 10 people and 9 of them are saying this. If you've done that a few times, you're like, okay, there's a pattern.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we were really focusing on the 1 to 10% of people that were saying, nah, why are they saying no? What's the factor? And because we were saying, look, it's probably going to cost maybe doubled the price to start with, and then 10% would say this is too expensive for us. And so that was like a really big thing for us. It's like, how do we make this cheaper? We need to vertically integrate our business model.
Yep.
And so there's things like that, focusing on the 1% that say no. It's like, why are they saying no?
That's gold. Thank you for sharing. All right, we're going to move to the hot seat round and then work towards wrapping. All right, first question. What's been your worst day at Great Wrap?
Oh, there's been a lot of tough days. I think... the day when we signed the lease on that first factory, I actually sit on a milk crate out front of all these car bodies and was just crying.
Jordy was crying and I was looking for, I was like, all right, okay, maybe this space won't work, just like on commercialrealestate.com, like trying to find a facility. I was like, it's okay, we can do it.
Yeah, terrible day.
Bad day.
What's been your best day at Great Wrap?
Oh, there's so many. Best day. I feel like launch days are always really exciting. Mainly because it's just like the whole team has done a massive push and you get to like release your baby into the world. So we've had a few of those now and they're my favorites because everyone just can, it's funny because actually the real work starts after you launch, but everyone's kind of like can sit back and have a glass of wine and just enjoy all the hard work.
Definitely feels like a music festival, like the ones that you go away for 2 days. So there's like a lot of prep. It's like, where are you going to get your booze from? How are you going to sneak it in? Where, you know, what else are you bringing for your campsite? And so it's like all this prep and then it's like the music festival is like 3 days of just like so much fun.
Yeah.
That's a launch. Like it's so good. And then afterwards.
Correct. Yeah. All right. If you were to start over again, what would you do differently?
Nothing and everything, I feel like. Yeah, I think about this all the time. But, I definitely think I wish I knew all the technical information I knew now because that pilot factory probably would have structured some things differently. But, you know, at the end of the day, like how are you going to know all the technical information that you know once you've actually done it after 3 or 4 years? So. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't do it differently, I guess.
There's a few things maybe product-wise, like there's product improvements that I would have waited on rather than like pushing. Yes. I think sometimes, especially when you have investors, you feel pressure to push through things.
Yes.
We definitely have worked on that and kind of improved doing that. But in the early days, yeah, I'd changed that part.
Yeah, we've definitely gone to market with some products that weren't ready for market.
Yeah.
It's a common theme.
Yeah.
What about your business gets you both excited?
Oh, so many things. It's just like every day is different. It's just constantly problem solving, meeting new people. Like also I feel like, you know, for me, I was excited about architecture because it's really fun because you get to like imagine a future, design it and it'll happen. But at Great Wrap, we actually get to do that every day and like put it together with your hands, which I find exciting.
Yeah, I just get excited. Like I feel like Great Wrap we can use as a vehicle for really massive sort of change. And we're looking at expanding into Europe and the US at the moment. We're looking at new feedstocks that are even more infinite than potato waste. And we're looking at expanding out to all forms of soft plastics and changing those. And so then, you know, it might take a long time for that to happen. But to know that we're a part of something that could be, yeah, this vehicle for change is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you. What's something you've learnt today?
This day, Sorry, I know this is supposed to be a rapid answer.
I can go first.
Please. I'm not in the hot seat.
I learned how to override a dozing unit for an extruder because it broke yesterday, and I've been working through it with our mechanical engineer. So,
wow.
Yeah, we figured out how to override it and get it running again. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's good. That's good. No, I think that's enough learning for today.
Last question. If you could have dinner with, I'd love to hear from both of you guys, if you could have dinner with any entrepreneur, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I don't know if you'd count him as an entrepreneur, but I would love to have dinner with Louis Theroux just because I feel he can go into a room with any person and have a conversation that feels really comfortable. And I think you can learn a lot from doing that. And I think that would be an amazing skill to bring into the business, like to business, to just be able to go anywhere and have a great conversation.
He's definitely an entrepreneur. Like Louis Theroux's a brand. It was, you know.
I'm thinking like,
really good question. I mean, like I love spending time in the ocean and surfing and always looked up to Kelly Slater as a kid. He's gone and started a whole bunch of businesses. He's an inspiring sort of person, and I feel like if I was going to have dinner, at least we could have a pretty well-rounded conversation about work and surfing. So I thought it'd be nice, and that'd be a really good chat.
That was a good one. Awesome. Well, look, Geordie, Julia, thank you so much for coming down here, and congratulations on all of your success thus far. I'll be watching from afar and hearing from Jake around how you guys are conquering the world, but thank you so much for sharing.
No, thanks so much for having us. It's great.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this interview. As you might already know, our mission at Founder is to help tens of millions of people every single week with our content, either start or grow their business, which is exactly why we're partnering with world-class founders such as Damon John, Alexa Von Tobel, Greta Van Riel, and so many more to teach crucial skills such as negotiation, finance, e-commerce, and so much more. So if you'd like to get access to these free exclusive trainings, please go to founder.com/free. These are 100%. We go super in depth on teaching a particular topic, and I know that you're going to love them if you enjoy this podcast. So just go to founder.com/free. All right, guys, I'll see you in the next episode.